Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of Hidden Noise, a new arts and culture podcast brought to you by Even Magazine.
Before we start today's show, we want to quickly thank Ruben Osland and Simone Castets for joining us on episode 1. If you missed it, hear about Osland's film The Square and Simone's recommendations for happenings in New York. The episode is now available on iTunes and other platforms.
As for today, we have a very exciting lineup. We will start by covering the Carolee Schneeman retrospective at MoMA PS1, and in Critical Conversations, our editor Jason Farrago will be joined by artist Thomas Hirshhorn. And finally, for the Even 8 this week, we'll be joined by Rosalie Goldberg of Performa. But as promised, we will start off with our go-see. So let's get started with perhaps one of my favorite exhibitions to date.
Yeah, you've been pretty excited about this one.
And it exceeded every expectation.
This week's go-see is Carolee Schneeman, Kinetic Painting, at MoMA PS1.
Not only is this the largest retrospective on Schneeman to date, but the exhibition neglects very little of her work. It's huge. Starting with her rarely shown early landscape paintings from the 50s, the exhibition follows the course of Schneeman's six-decade career through painting, assemblage, film, performance, and experimental theater.
But before we get carried away with the show itself, we'll go ahead and give you some background on Schneeman and her prolific career.
Carolee Schneeman was one of the pioneers of feminist performance in the 1960s and has since maintained a critical role in female performance, film, and installation.
I want to give our listeners a little bit of personal context. When you're an undergraduate art history major, you learn about Carolee Schneeman. In fact, she's one of about 4 performance artists that make it into post-war 101, and she, along with about 4 other artists, define a breakthrough moment for feminism and experimental media.
That being said, Schneeman actually began her career in the 50s as a trained painter. After dabbling in both landscape and abstraction, Schneeman began her painting constructions, expanding into 3 dimensional assemblages, which included both kinetic material and everyday objects, not terribly dissimilar to Rauschenberg's combines, for those of you who saw the recent exhibition at MoMA.
Schneeman came to New York in 1961 at the age of 22. A year later, she had already begun translating painting into choreography for both the Living Theater and Judson Dance Theater. It wasn't long before Schneeman became an integral player in avant-garde experimental dance and theater performances across the city. She became increasingly concerned with the female body and this idea of the artist as both image and image maker, which is the art history way of saying she was both the creator and subject of her work. She began interrogating and challenging visual culture's then staid representations of gender and sexuality and the female body, all of which are also part of the politics of art history itself.
There is an extreme focus on the female body. Over decades of work, Schneeman responded to an overwhelming trivialization and marginalization of various lived experiences, whether it be sex, menstruation, AIDS. There is a lot of neglect, disdain, and disgust that Schneeman directly responds to in her work, and she's quite clear about it.
As a result, you'd think that the show was crushingly heavy, an onslaught of pain and suffering, but it's really much more engaging and much more contemporary than that. After all, this woman won the Golden Lion at this year's Venice Biennale. She's still got it.
And PS1's got all of it. We can't stress enough how massive this show is. My highlight was a film installation on the second floor titled Water, Light, Water, Needle from 1966.
This piece presents a 2-channel, 16mm film of about 11 dancers moving between suspended ropes in a forest. The movement is simple and slow and concentrates on the way that the bodies interact with both each other and gravity, rather than being centered around any kind of choreography.
Over the duration, different pieces of footage are layered on top of one another, so bodies appear on planes that don't exist, and it creates this constellation of bodies in space with no singular perspective to ground the viewer. Schneeman's work predates some extremely important multimedia performances, including Lucinda Child's piece titled Dance from 1979, for which she collaborated with Saul LeWitt and Philip Glass. In this piece, dancers on stage interact with projections of dancers behind them, changing scale, time, and disorienting the audience's perspective. Kara Lee was first.
So definitely plan to spend some time at the museum to recognize how instrumental Schneeman was. And we recommend starting on the second floor as opposed to the first. The second floor galleries host much of the artist's earlier work, starting with her abstract landscape paintings from the 50s through a lot of her early experimental film and performance pieces. And then downstairs, you'll find her later work centered around intimacy, violence, and mourning.
And finally, the wall texts. As you know, we usually have an opinion. And this time, I urge you to just read. Walk, look, observe, experience, and read the wall texts. I promise you will learn something.
The show's a retrospective. There are 6 decades worth of work, all of which is being created in completely different contexts and cultural climates. Schneeman's work responds to those differences. Pay attention to what's happening, to the social mores. They matter here.
I could go on for hours about how important I think Schneeman's work is and this show, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that. We strongly urge you to trek over to PS1 this weekend. You can also pick up the current issue of Even at the bookstore.
And relish in the moment. It's been a long time coming for Schneeman. Her gallery, PPOW, has tirelessly supported her work, mostly unnoticed by anyone except sophomore art history students, and definitely unnoticed by the market. For full disclosure, one of the curators was one of my graduate school professors, but that happens a lot.
We also want to turn your attention to Chelsea, where, unlike MoMA, museum quality exhibitions are on view for free. We are so spoiled to live in New York, and everyone should be taking advantage of these spaces, usually open on Saturdays, to see new work.
I'm particularly excited about 2 exhibitions. Cecily Brown, who's having a show at Paula Cooper Gallery, and Jessica Jackson Hutchins at Marion Boesky. Cecily's a painter whose work falls somewhere between landscape and porn. And this is her first major show at the gallery, having left Gagosian, which is sort of like leaving the Yankees for better, more modern management. Jessica's work is installation-based. You may have seen a massive couch covered in newspaper and ceramic at the Whitney Biennial a few iterations back. That's her.
We also want to talk about Thomas Hirschhorn, the Swiss-born, internationally celebrated, and extremely charming artist, is best known for his massive sculptural constructions and installations.
His last gallery show, Concordia Concordia, was inspired by the cruise ship that infamously capsized and sank in 2012. In the gallery, ceilings were turned into walls, paper, furniture, everything was tipped on its side. It was an immersive nightmare, injected with quite a bit of pop.
Thomas had the chance to speak to our editor, Jason Farrago, as he was installing his upcoming show at Gladstone Gallery. So now we will turn it over to them. Here's Jason with Thomas Hirschhorn.
So maybe we could talk about the pixel collages first, and then maybe a little more generally about the work with found images really since 2006, but I would love to start with the pixel collages. These works combine found images that are extremely difficult to look at, along with images of a different register, sometimes from fashion, sometimes street photography, and substantial portions of them are pixelated, though not the portions of them that would be pixelated if they were, say, in a mass media context. Can you maybe first tell me a little bit about the technique of pixelation, what pixelation sort of signifies to you in a media context, and then how it works in these works here?
To me, first of all, I'm interested in, not in the technique, I'm interested in the abstraction of it. And therefore, I thought it's a good existing element, the pixels, because I know there are other elements today, for example, to hide pictures like blurring, or masking, but I choose the pixels because they have this aesthetic of abstraction inside. Yeah, so it's not about the technique of pixelation, it's more about the decision of it. I mean, which part is pixelized or not. Therefore, I cut it myself, not the machine, the computer does decide which part is pixelized. I myself, in a very anachronic way, I cut out the pixels. And in order to show that behind the pixels is something else.
Since 2006, when you had a show called Superficial Engagement here at Gladstone Gallery, which was really at the height of the Iraq War here in the United States, you've been exposing images that are, as you say, easy to find and even easier as the years go by on Google or on other internet sources. And yet the political influence of these images has remained pretty small, at least in the United States. Certainly after 9/11, or certainly even more after 2003, when the Iraq War began, there was a kind of unofficial ban on it showing these images in the American media, that it was demoralizing to the war effort, or it was somehow humanistically beyond the pale to look. And you could find arguments both on the political right and on the political left for people who said that these images were improper to look at or to circulate. You've always insisted that we look, and not only look, but that we look at the volume of the images and not just their individual stories. Of course, in these works and in most of your other works, the source is very rarely identified. Even the war in which this takes place is usually not identified. Is the individual case, the individual life, less important or less accessible than the totality of the kind of image world that these come from?
You know, one of the reasons why I think it's important to look and to show to the picture of destroyed human bodies is because the redundancy, the incredible redundancy of it. And it's not that the one is less important, but it starts with the one. But also, we need to know it starts with the one, but it never stops, really. This is, I think, the hardcore. I mean, the core of the... It's not about the numbers, but it's about the dynamic. And I think it starts with one, but even when I can't see one, because it's about this, why I can't see one? Because nobody wants to show it to me because somebody says I cannot support to look at it, or even I would get a victim on looking on it, or the victim is here on the picture. That's the real victim, the person. So I think I had to insist, but also this was not what I thought when I started, but also I had to insist because even almost every month or even more we had this kind of now attacks, you know, that people are in mass killed, no? Not only on war zones, but also here and in our cities. So I think, and I'm astonished just that still, nothing is to see. So I'm astonished by this, because as you mentioned you yourself, probably the sentence of Rumsfeld, from the former Secretary of State, images of horror of war have decorating impact on the effort for war, and it seems that.
Have a discouraging
nothing. Yes, right. Yes, nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm. There was a line of thought in the late 20th century, certainly Susan Sontag was probably the most vocal here, who would insist that it was morally perilous to look at images of war, that they could never fully testify to the horrors of what people lived, and therefore, for those of us who sit comfortably in big cities or in art galleries or in books, we were either blinding ourselves or we were in some way betraying the lives of the people who had died or who had suffered. Sontag changed her tune as she got older, but that argument has endured, I think, a lot in the art world and also in the media, which is why people pixelate. I'd like to understand how, without context, these images remain an ethical responsibility to look at.
To me, these kind of, for example, pictures I use from the internet, to me, they never lost their impact, they never lost their power, they never lost their universality, and therefore I use it without the context, because the big problem, I think, is the context.
Yes.
Who wants to explain me already what happened? And even if I can look to a body, a dead body, a destroyed body, that maybe there are indications. Is he a victim, or is he or she a
part of propaganda?
Yeah, so therefore, I think I must do my contribution to this thematic, to this discussion, and to what I see in the world.
One of the most important parts of your work since the beginning, but especially since 2006, has been thinking about these images not just as individual photographs, but as images that circulate, images that move around the world. And you bring up social media, which really wasn't as large of a concern around 2006. Facebook just began around then. YouTube, which I think is one of the most under-researched social networks for these sorts of images, had just begun in 2006. And you know, you mention how these things circulate and circulate and they get more and more comments. In many ways, as an image becomes more and more and more viral, it actually can make you more skeptical about its truth value rather than more. But if it gets 8 million likes or 20 million likes, it could very well be because it is false. And a lie, this is Adorno's famous line, a lie gets out here much faster than the truth does. And I guess I want to maybe finish by talking about questions about truth. The question around whether photographs, particularly war photographs, tell the truth is a long-standing one. But as these things move online, it becomes very, very difficult to know whether a single image is truly testifying to the truth, or at least the partial truth, of a violent act, even if it is coming from a source that you might find more credible, that if you have more sympathy for Kurdish Syrian freedom fighters than you do for ISIS, that might nevertheless be engaged in an image war that goes alongside a war on the ground. I guess that, for me, is an important question to ask you, is about how you assess these images' truth value online versus how you assess their truth value in the gallery.
I mean, as an artist, I want to reach truth with my work. If I do the pixel collage, to me, a pixel collage is truth. Not is the truth of something, but is truth. I think on an artwork, it is truth. Means if I look to a painting of Mondrian, it's a true, it's truth. No? It's not saying something about something, a fact or event or whatever. It's truth as such. And I think we artists, we are dealing with this big question. Can we establish a work of art which owns her or his own truth? And then somebody can reach with it. But it's, of course, not about the truth of something, because then it would be an illustration, or it would be a press photograph of something.
Yeah, art has another vocation, right? Art.
So to me, I want to do a work. I'm sure that I'm far away to touch this, but I want to do a work which in itself is truth. And of course, I'm interested in the pixel collage, for example. I'm interested in even the misunderstandings who are perhaps inside because they're pictures people are used to see or not used to see also, because they don't, that the question of the truth arises, of course. So, but that's something else, because this is only the verification of a fact. I'm not interested in it, clearly not. But of course, I'm interested in this switch to say, yes, in this world, and you know it better than me, in this post-truth world, yeah, of course. So it cannot be me, artist, who goes into the trap, for example, of the journalists who deals with truth, or trying to deal with truth, which is, I think, an old term, because it's not more working. That I say,
so what is the journalist's not truth, not working? You mean can't simply tell a story?
It's not more working. It's not more operative. Not more operative. It's not more important in a way. Because back to your question in the beginning, I am interested that in the internet, in the social media, there's so much of pictures, they're fake. And I think it's important that they're fake. I'm not saying I got the point, is it fake or not fake? But there are so much pictures, so much things, they're completely out of, they left this question, is this true?
The very question of whether these
there's
are
no
true
more
or
question.
Fiction is no longer.
Absolutely. And I think this is interesting. This is about. But not in a way then to find again, is it true, is it not true? Sometimes, for example, I see in YouTube, as you mentioned, somebody said, yeah, there is some fact, yeah, but is it fake or not fake? But it's completely, I think it's stupid to ask, is it fake or not fake? It is, the picture is. And this, I think, we have to reach. And this is, I think, it's a point too interesting. And therefore, I need to call abstraction. To see it completely abstract, far away of the informations, who could be behind, the context I don't have, whatever. And therefore, I think art at some points can be in contact with this or in conflict. It's not a solution, of course, but there is the contact. I try to do with my artwork with this question of fake, truth, question of doing something who makes sense or and for other is nonsense. So therefore, it's a good tool, I think.
And I think one of the most unfair objections that people began to make to art in the late 20th century was that it was inevitably going to be part of a big spectacle culture, a world of images in which, you know, as de Boer would argue, it was just capital that had been reified into an image, and therefore it could never possibly have any truth value in the world at large. And there have been so many techniques that artists have found, one of the most important of which I would point out is collage. Collage, when the modernists, Picasso and Braque, and then also the Dadaists, began to look at collage, was a way to collide images and to put disjunctive images together, like you say, if the scales are wrong or if the angles are wrong, in such a way that it disrupted the principal ways, the normal ways by which we looked at images. And I could maybe finish here that for the modernists, for the Dadaists, collage was such an important tool as media was changing, as radio, as daily newspapers. These guys were media junkies, right? And I wonder if for you too, at a moment when media is shifting completely, does collage seem to offer a way to make sense of things?
Absolutely. And I mean, there are a lot of young artists that work with video, for example, and use all these kind of social medias to do collage. There's something I would like also. I'm really happy that you finish with collage, because to me, it was always the base of my work, my love. But also something I really love in collage. And I think it's true that almost everybody in the life, in her lifetime or his lifetime, did once a collage, you know. And I think it's a very universal, media. And I love to do it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Big thank you to Thomas Hirschhorn for taking the time to talk to Jason a little bit about his work and upcoming show, Depixelation. We hope all of you make it over to Gladstone Gallery either this week or next week to see his exhibition and experience these giant and very politically charged works in person. Up next, we want to welcome art historian, critic, curator, and Performa founder, Rosalie Goldberg, who will talk to us about the upcoming Performa Biennial. Rebecca, take it away.
So I wanted to get started by asking you a couple of questions about the beginning of Performa. This is the 7th biennial, but for a number of our listeners, this is sort of the first they know. So I was hoping you could give a brief overview of how Performa started and what its mission is.
Great. With pleasure. Great to be talking to you both. So Performa is an organization that I decided was an absolute necessity in New York City. I started in 2004 with the idea that we needed to make this town radical and a little irritating again, to really look at how art bubbles up from the bottom. I felt that New York was getting way too top heavy, that we were looking at, you know, the great, wonderful institutions uptown, the great, wonderful, huge spaces in Chelsea that look more like boat showrooms and so on. And the New York that I really came here for a long time ago was the downtown that we owned downtown, and nobody came below 14th Street, which was fantastic. And to really say, we've got to stir the ground up again. A little more background for those who are meeting us for the first time today. I wrote a book, which came out in 1979, on the history of artist performance. Again, to be very clear, and maybe to avoid any definitions that might get confusing, artists have always worked in a lot of different media. Leonardo da Vinci worked in different media. If there was a ball or somebody's wedding, that was part of the job description of a 15th century artist, was to be able to do some extraordinary event for the royal courts and so on. So throughout the history of art and throughout the history of 20th century art, looking at the way artists work across disciplines has been my personal drum to beat, because I felt that that whole area has been left out of art history. So again, for the general listener, for somebody who's coming and saying, well, what is this thing called performance, Performa, and performance art? We're really asking artists to reach out and do very public artworks. And again, that accessibility to the artist is interesting how accessible that is. That I think it occurs because you're looking at one human being looking at another human being. And so we have this engagement right away. So the nice surprise that it's both seems a little strange, seems a little new, and yet when people are right there in the space with an artist doing a particular work, they get it. You don't need a sort of a higher degree in art history to be able to understand what's going on.
And for you, Performa is structured as a biennial every 2 years. at the beginning of November for a set number of weeks, you guys will take over various spaces all over New York City with specific commissions by artists from around the world. Can you talk a little bit about how you sort of structure the show, where to find Performa? There's always a hub that some people do and do not know about, and how to sort of engage with it in the city?
That's a great question. So let's begin with the hub, because as you say, people don't know about it, and they should, because it's a great place to hang out, literally. Again, I have to, without being sentimental, I have to go back and say the downtown New York that I first met, we all had very specific bars and clubs, especially, that we hung out. You know, Finelli, for example, been there forever on the corner of Prince and Mercer Street. And these were places where you hung out for conversation, arguments, discussions. It was a very exciting time. Or Max's Kansas City, for those of you who know a little bit about New York history, that was, again, a place that you could go there. Andy Warhol was there. David Bowie was there. Smithson was there. Vito Conti was there. You know, Lucy Lippard, really fantastic artists. Mary Miss, names you might not know, but again, do take a peek at some art history books to give you a sense. I wanted Performa to have that quality, so hence the hub. Because we have a little office up on 23rd and 6th, which is so intense and exciting, but it's not a place that the public can find us. So during the biennial, the Performa hub comes up very fast because we have to find a space that's empty and available. I call it instant architecture, just add water, because we usually get it 2 or 3 weeks before we run because, you know, again, it's just really how can we get something at a price we can afford? And we build and design it in less than 3 weeks. So we will open November 1st. Be there because we're open from noon till 8 every day. And the idea is you will be able to meet curators. I will be there. Come and say hello. There'll be writers there. There'll be artists there. And it becomes a WeWork space for this duration, which is 3 weeks. It's also an exhibition space. There'll be talks there. It's a place for engagement. So going over some of your other points, it is 3 weeks. We do take over different spaces around the city. Actually, one of the most interesting responses. I had a group came in from Korea once of curators, and they just said, we've never seen New York like this. They were running up to Harlem. They were going to the Bronx. They were going to deep parts of Brooklyn that, we discovered. And this year, again, we're at the Black Lady Theater in, I believe it's at Crown Heights. We're up at 118th Street in Harlem. We're at the Bronx Museum. We're at a Bronx Community Center. And the idea, again, is that you're discovering New York. It's a kind of urbanism. And that's very much part of the intention to do that. We're at little theaters that are just gems, like the Connolly Theater in the Lower East Side, on the East 4th. What else? There are such surprising spaces that really, really interesting artists are there. But we also work in collaboration with the Met Museum. We're doing a project on the stage in the auditorium there. We worked with the Guggenheim. We worked with MoMA. So we try to create this collaborative link of so many different spaces and places in the city. And again, it's definitely a time to explore New York and then to get there and actually sit down for an hour and be close up and very intensely engaged with an artist's work.
In the decades since you've been starting to work on Performa, has there been a specific space that's been your favorite discovery?
Gosh, there are a lot of them. We actually have amazing archives on discoveries. We've discovered through Julie Moretto this beautiful church, now decommissioned church, on 118th Street in Harlem. Absolutely stunning, a kind of, you know, Gothic Revival kind of church that's actually been reconvened as a kind of music space, and she was using it as her studio. Each of the projects, I would say they usually start with an idea, and then in Julie's case, this was really her space that she brought us into, and then we will be doing other things there, so it's an opportunity for people to experience this place through her eyes in a way, but then we're also having a project there with William Kentridge, so there'll be other projects there at this beautiful space, and again, we love that people will discover a new kind of New York.
And aside from the performance and knowing that obviously you are a specialist on that subject, in an ideal world where, you know, you had all the time and energy to put into it, is there anything else you would see yourself specializing in or becoming a leading expert on?
Oh, if I had another life, it'd be to be a swimmer or something. I don't know.
something physical?
Yeah, something I don't do, and I always wish I had the courage to do it. Yes, another specialty. You know, I grew up as a dancer, which probably where a lot of this comes from. So there you go. In fact, for a long time, we seemed to be hiring dancers because I think dancers are perfectionists.
Not true.
Absolute perfectionist, nothing is good enough because every next turn has to be better than the one before. Mm. Yes, all these worlds. And the beauty, by the way, of performance, and thank you for saying that because I'd like you to come up with some ideas for us, is that we're such a flexible institution. We've created this organization that is both, in a sense, an institution. I wanted to make the history performance well known. Mm-hmm. I wanted to deal with the contemporary and provoke the future and say, let's commission new works for the 21st century. And I wanted to stop time. I wanted to say, hold on, slow down, because we all race through museums and we race through galleries and we think we're looking at things. And I know there's statistics, but we spend seconds on every artwork. So back to your question, you know, what would you like to see us do? And the fact is that as an institution, we have a profound history that we're always investigating, but we can also be anything we want to be. We don't have a mandate that says you can only be A or B or C. We've worked with filmmakers, we work with contemporary dancers, we work with ballet dancers, we work with the avant-garde in many different fields. We can work with writers. We're doing a piece this year with Teju Cole, who's never gone live in the way he's going live. And that's the excitement, too, is to watch somebody in one medium break through. And to listen to him talk is absolutely wonderful, because he makes this distinction between being the writer, i.e. being in his head, being the photographer, i.e. being in a place, you know, he's holding the camera, and now he feels bringing this emotional segment to the installation that he will do, and he's actually going to be singing, and he's made videos. So it's taken him into such an expansive way of thinking about the way he sees the world. So we're seeing the writer, the photographer, and the thinker emerge in this different way, and then people having a chance to actually be close up and watching him in action. So these are wonderful qualities that I think we all enjoy, because it's a way to access the artist's mind, whether it's the writer, the painter, the photographer, or the filmmaker or musician.
Tickets to the various performances are now available at performant-arts.org.
And we should encourage everyone. I will not ask Rosalie to pick favorites, because that would be impossible. I'm sure they are all equally her baby. But to keep an eye out for Teju Cole, for Julie Maritou, for William Kentridge, to get to the hub at some point and enact a sort of wonderful social space that Performa puts on for everyone every couple of years. Thank you so much, Rosalie, for having us.
Thank you for your great questions, conversations, and for becoming part of the team as of today.
So just to recap, we strongly urge everybody to go to PS1 this weekend, check out the Carolee Schneeman retrospective, go to Chelsea, see Thomas Hirshhorn's exhibition at Gladstone Gallery, and go online where you can purchase all your tickets to the various events that are going to be part of the Performa Biennial.
I'm Rebecca Siegel.
And I'm Abby Sandler.
And this is Hidden Noise.